I'm Christopher Lighton with the rare war reporter Nir Rosen, who covers Iraq and Afghanistan as if there were real people on the ground between the wrecking ball of American military force and the junkyard dogs of warlords who end up owning so much of the wreckage. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Aftermath is Nir Rosen's doorstop of a new book, nearly 600 pages of reporting following the bloodshed of America's wars in the Muslim world. Reading it all, Nir Rosen, I keep thinking, on some great judgment day, Americans are going to have to account for what we knew about this story. And if we didn't know, why not? By way of introduction, may I just say what a striking figure you are on this job. An American born in New York with a bouncer's build, a Jewish name, but with Iranian blood too, deep olive skin and a huge Middle Eastern mustache that let you go native, plus the courage to hit the street in Iraq and Lebanon and Egypt and Afghanistan, solo act, not embedded, not with a New York Times or CNN credential, just out there to report what you saw. I'm hoping you'll just tell us what our naked eyes would see in Iraq today and then Afghanistan. Maybe later we'll look at Lebanon and Israel and possibly more trouble ahead. But walk us around Baghdad in 2011, if you will.
Well, the first thing which you may notice is the huge number of checkpoints. It's a heavily militarized city. It used to feel like the Americans were occupying it. These days it feels like Iraqi security forces are occupying it. And every block or every few minutes you are stopped at a checkpoint. Your ID is checked. Your car is searched. Obviously there are security reasons for doing that, but it's also a very onerous kind of development and a real hassle. And a real shift from Iraq of pre-2003. You'll notice concrete walls. The walls that the Americans put up remain.
Jersey barriers?
Surrounding... Jersey barriers are the small ones, only a few feet. Then you have the very big ones, which are like 12, 15 feet tall, surrounding neighborhoods, surrounding buildings, surrounding markets, sort of blocking how far you can see things. Some of them have been painted with murals or covered with political posters, so it takes away from the gray. You'll see a very dirty city, unfortunately, very poor sanitation since the occupation began. Often large pools of sewage or water, huge piles of trash and dirt, wild dogs, and this is a thoroughly urban environment.
Hmm.
Due to poverty and flight from rural areas to urban areas, you'll see in much of the city people tending their flocks of sheep or goats, and these sheep or goats will be eating trash. And you'll see a lot of new shops in the last year have opened up, internet cafes, restaurants, shopping, as security has improved somewhat. You won't see very many tall buildings or too much construction, although in the last year there's been some increase in building and construction. For the most part, the first 7 years of the occupation, almost nothing new was being built, just things were being blown up. You won't see any Americans anymore. Really, since 2009, most Iraqis didn't confront Americans on a daily basis as the Americans pulled out of Iraq's cities, most of them at least, and handed over security to the Iraqi security forces. You won't see militias anymore. There was a time until maybe 2008 when militias controlled neighborhoods and villages and checkpoints. That phase is over, and these days it's Iraqi police and Iraqi army everywhere, literally everywhere. Each neighborhood is sort of owned by an Iraqi police or army unit. So it still feels very much like you're in a heavily militarized security zone, but you won't see foreigners.
How do you know, or how would I know, Nir Rosen, that the place has been ethnically resorted, if not quite cleansed?
A casual observer wouldn't necessarily be able to tell that. You would perhaps see the remnants of destroyed homes. There are certain neighborhoods which are still partial ghost towns because so many people have fled. You would see in Shia areas a huge number of Shia religious or sectarian flags or posters or banners, which is a post-2003 development when they can confidently express their identity. You wouldn't see anything like that in Sunni neighborhoods. I mean, there's no visible difference between Sunnis and Shia, so you wouldn't be able to tell that. But certainly that is the case, that you have very few mixed areas left in Baghdad or in Iraq, which used to be, Baghdad was a very cosmopolitan mixed area, Sunnis, Shias, Christians, Kurds, and others living in many of the same neighborhoods. Many neighborhoods were sort of split 50-50 or 60-40. And for the most part, that element of Iraq's social fabric has been totally destroyed and will probably never be repaired.
Sum it up in terms of your own mixed verdict on the surge. The line that we've all heard, of course, is that we may have botched the occupation and stripped Iraq too soon of its old order, the Ba'athist order, but that the surge fixed it up. We can turn the page, as President Obama puts it. Tom Friedman in the New York Times sums it up after all this as a million acts of kindness on the American part. How fixed would Iraq look to us?
To anybody who's been there, it wouldn't look very fixed. There has been a relative decline in violence since the peak of the Civil War period, which really was from like 05 to 07, 08. And you no longer, as I said, see militias controlling streets or checkpoints or neighborhoods. You no longer see Americans conducting patrols or arrests. But it's Iraq is destroyed and broken and dirty and decaying and sick. And yes, Thomas Friedman talked about a million acts of kindness. I think for any Iraqi, that would be outrageous, and they would remember a million explosions, a million assassinations and killings and deaths and displacements and arrests. And they would blame the U.S. for this because all this followed the American occupation and the chaos we created and the sectarian structures we imposed on the country. So a million acts of occupation and brutality may be more correct from an Iraqi point of view. The surge is hard to talk about because it means so many things, or nothing perhaps. The surge, strictly speaking, was just an increase in American troops by 30,000 or 15%, which began in January 2007. But the surge has come to mean a period of time and a complex array of Iraqi and American dynamics. So that period of time now kind of spans late 2006 until 2008. And during that period, we saw a peak in violence by the middle of 2007, and then a gradual decline until the levels we see today, which are still terrible. Every day people are dying from assassinations and bombings. It's much worse in Afghanistan, actually. But compared to the peak of the Civil War, it is an improvement. Now, in American mythology, which is almost impossible to challenge these days, the surge was a success, and General Petraeus is a great American hero and savior, and he will also save Afghanistan with his own surge. Now, I argue that the surge wasn't a success, and even the term success is meaningless, because there was a civil war in Iraq, which we created. We, the U.S., were the cause of the civil war. And then we were also involved in helping to mitigate the civil war. So at best, you could say that we helped reduce the damage that we did in the first place. But the surge was also meant to create a space, sort of a reduction in violence, which would allow for Iraqi political reconciliation and integration of Sunni militiamen and Sunni parties, and some kind of democracy, which never happened. I argue that it never happened, but it doesn't really have to happen for Iraq to continue on its current trajectory, in that Prime Minister Maliki can just be as authoritarian as he wants, and nothing's going to happen. Nobody can do anything about it. So what is being created is an increasingly authoritarian Iraqi state where Shias are the majority and Shias control the government and security forces, and there's nobody who can challenge that. So whether they integrate other groups or not doesn't really matter. Practically speaking, obviously for moral reasons it matters, and ideally there should be representation, but not having that will not lead to greater violence. The civil war ended because Shias were sufficiently dominant numerically and militarily that they could defeat their Sunni rivals. That's what it came down to. So there was a reduction in violence, not primarily because of Petraeus and his surge, but because of the surge in Shia militiamen and Iraqi security forces, which just brutally crushed their rivals. If I was going to have sort of a company that sponsored the so-called American success, it would be Black & Decker, the maker of power drills. Because the power drill marks in a corpse was a signature of Shia militiamen. If you find a corpse and its head was cut off, you knew a Sunni militiaman killed him. If you found the corpse with power drill marks on the body, you knew he was tortured to death by Shia militia.
Mm.
And this became so routine and widespread, along with other abuses and civilian casualties and murders and kidnappings conducted by both Shia militiamen and the Shia-dominated Iraqi police and Iraqi army, that it crushed the Sunni opposition, and they were finally forced to realize that they were a small, vulnerable, weak minority, looking, sort of staring at the abyss on the verge of extermination, and that forced them to change their calculus, ally with the Americans, which led to the awakening phenomenon, Sons of Iraq, and that changed everything.
But the short form is Black and Decker won.
Terror won. And so, yes, we took sides in a civil war that we helped create, and one side emerged dominant and crushed the other side. And we called that success, and we moved on to Afghanistan.
May I just say, you remind me of another wonderful reporter on this war, Anthony Shadid, won two Pulitzer Prizes, coming in with the Americans and then exiting with the Americans. Both won big prizes. He's back there for the New York Times. But he said to me in a conversation with incredible frustration that for all this reporting, he didn't think he'd conveyed the simple point, which was that we smashed a country and it'll stay smashed for a very, very long time, maybe forever.
Well, and that smashing, first of all, I appreciate any comparison to Anthony Shadid. He's maybe the greatest American reporter in the Middle East. And what makes him unique, or relatively unique, is that he actually speaks Arabic. There are a handful of others. I speak Arabic. Leila Fadel from Washington Post. Well, what that means is that he also views non-white people as human, which is a revolutionary idea for people, believe it or not, in that you're able to focus on the people, whether in Africa or the Middle East or elsewhere, and tell their story and care and empathize with them and view them as important, which is difficult for any group, talking about a different group, and seems to be very challenging for Americans and for American journalists who may focus too often on English-speaking elites or on the Americans in the country. But yet, the American smashing of Iraq, to go back to Anthony Shadid's point, began, you could say, during the sanctions era, or even before, in the Gulf War. We destroyed Iraq in 1991, and then we imposed sanctions on them, further just destroying the country economically, socially, in terms of health care. The middle class was wiped out. The Iraqi state became much, much more powerful because it was the only agency which could provide food. People really depended on it for their lives. People became more religious, which led to what we saw post-occupation, the rise of religious militias. And then we bombed Iraq again, of course, in Operation Desert Fox, 1998. And finally, after the sanctions totally emaciated and weakened and starved the country, we bombed the hell out of it once again in 2003, and then created a total security vacuum, which led to looting and the creation of militias and a pervasive sense of lawlessness, which remains in Iraq to this day. And then, of course, the resistance and the creation of terrorist groups, which targeted Iraqi civilians and militia groups, which oppressed them and also fought the Americans. And the brutal American occupation, which led to thousands of innocent deaths, tens of thousands of Iraqi men arrested without charge, held for many years sometimes. That's tens of thousands of families who were traumatized, sons who saw their fathers being taken away. They're crying, "Daddy, Daddy," and some of them may have never even seen their daddy again. Women who couldn't provide for the families because their men were taken away. Millions of Iraqis displaced, either internally or abroad, destabilizing the entire region. And now, finally, an Iraqi government, which is brutal and tortures and is corrupt and is inefficient and provides no services. And this is a democracy and freedom we brought to the Iraqi people.
Mm. Nir Rosen, I want to get ahead to Afghanistan, where you've had your own difficult trial by fire with the Taliban. But one key thing in Iraq before we leave there, you have paid great attention to the refugee crisis, which most American media have not. We hear that there are 4.5 million displaced Iraqi people in Jordan, in Syria, within Iraq itself. These are the people who vote with their feet and are a very important barometer of what's really on in Iraq. What can you tell from that situation now?
Well, I think the figure of 4.5 million may be inflated. It seems like about 500,000 people at most may have fled Iraq abroad. Nobody knows the exact figures, but we do know that the Syrian and Jordanian government inflated the numbers because more refugees meant more money from international organizations.
Mm-hmm.
But 500,000 people is still a huge number. And they're in Syria, Jordan, Turkey, Yemen, Egypt. And that flight began in 2003, but became very intensive by 2005, 2006. And then internally, we have close to 2 million Iraqis who fled their homes to safer areas in Iraq. Shias going to Shia areas, Sunnis going to Sunni areas, Christians going to the north, perhaps. And they, most of them will never return to their homes, at least to their original homes. The majority will stay where they are, whether they're in safer parts of Iraq or whether they're in slums in Damascus or Amman, Jordan. Some of them are so traumatized they're too scared to go back.
Mm.
Others have been living for a few years in more comfortable or relatively safer areas, and they've just adjusted. You have 500,000 homeless Iraqis. Some of them living on, basically, when you visit them, it's like they're people living on a big pile of sewage.
Mm.
Flies buzzing all over the place. The stench makes it hard to breathe. Kids with running around barefoot playing in trash. Really very difficult to experience. And so many people you talk to have been so traumatized. One thing that strikes me whenever I'm in Iraq, not a family you meet has not been touched by violence, murder, kidnapping, beheadings, displacement, disappearances, arrests, and torture. Every family has suffered this.
Mm.
And as a journalist, you sort of end up getting callous. You hear the same stories over and over again. And then every once in a while, some woman reminds you of your mother and she starts crying. And suddenly you start crying when you hear her story. Some father crying about his son dying or something like that.
Mm.
It's a really shattered, psychologically traumatized country where the worst horror stories aren't even known. The Diyala province is a province which has really been neglected in the media because it's a little bit dangerous still. It's just sort of northeast of Baghdad. It borders Iran and Kurdistan in the north. Hundreds of villages in Diyala province were destroyed 6-7 months into the surge when violence was supposed to be going down. And when I say destroyed, I mean each home totally blown up. So all that's left of the home is a big pile of rubble and like women's shoes and some children's toys. And a quarter of the population of Diyala was displaced. Each village, many men were slaughtered. And these horrors and atrocities were never recorded at the time. We don't even know how many people died in the civil war in Iraq. Many more people than we'll ever know. Because nobody was there to record this violence. So I've been visiting these villages in the last year. Just a couple of months ago, I visited about 6 of them. This also happened in South Baghdad, in North Babel. Just atrocities that remind you of Rwanda and Bosnia.
Mm.
And they haven't been recorded. They haven't been explored. We've just moved on to the next war, to Afghanistan.
Neil Rosen, consider Afghanistan. This story sort of shuttles back and forth from Afghanistan to Iraq. Afghanistan in 2001 was, of course, the beginning, chasing out the Taliban the first time, a rehearsal for Iraq. Iraq began as shock and awe. It was supposed to be short, got bogged down in a civil war. A new counterinsurgency doctrine was invented and applied with, as you say, hugely mixed results. But now the surge and the latest counterinsurgency doctrine developed by General Petraeus are the name of the game in Afghanistan. You've been there. You've seen it. What is the promise of the new so-called COIN, COIN, for counterinsurgency?
Well, it's a false promise. I should say that Afghanistan in 2001 was not a rehearsal for Iraq, in that you had a handful of special forces guys riding around on horseback, so very light footprint, as opposed to the shock and awe and massive military force used in the invasion of Iraq. I think, in fact, that's why they wanted Iraq. Afghanistan was seen as sort of, at the time, strategically insignificant, not a real enemy. They wanted more of a showdown with a proper foe and a real victory against something that could remind them of World War II, than the fascists, the communists, that kind of thing. But counterinsurgency, not exactly developed by General Petraeus, although he's credited with it. He did sign his name on the manual, although dozens of other people were involved in writing it, actually. Maybe he crossed a few T's and dotted a few I's on it. It's the theory of war where you're trying to, the way the Americans phrase it at least, win over the population, stop their support for the insurgents by tempting them with a variety of incentives, security, political, financial, otherwise, and create some kind of strong local government which can take over security. So it involves killing the so-called irreconcilable insurgents and reconciling other insurgents. I argue that in Afghanistan today, we're not actually really practicing counterinsurgency even. In Iraq, it was a little bit easier for the Americans by 2007. They could actually live with the people, which was a big part of the doctrine, to base yourself in neighborhoods. And they did that in Baghdad and elsewhere. They had a partner in the Iraqi government that was strong and willing and able to take over security in the country, even if it was brutal and corrupt. Now, in Afghanistan, everything is different. The rural nature and remote nature of the country, no roads, many thousands of little villages, makes it almost impossible to live with the population. So they have to commute to work, as they say, which means that the Taliban own the night and they can undermine whatever the Americans, whatever deal they strike when they visit. And maybe have some tea with an elder. But they're also being, under Petraeus, increasingly aggressive. They called their tactic in Iraq population-centric counterinsurgency, meaning they were trying trying to protect the population. In reality, it's more about controlling the population, building walls around them, preventing any other authority from taking over. But during the surge in Iraq, which was supposed to be about protecting the population, three times as many Iraqi civilians were killed by the Americans as before. So it didn't feel very population-centric for a lot of the Iraqi population. Likewise, our war in Afghanistan is very brutal. This is the nature of war, so I'm not singling out the Americans as if they're some kind of malign actor, but the nature of war is brutality, and population-centric counterinsurgency involves brutalizing the population until they end up supporting you or not supporting the insurgents. And we're destroying villages in Helmand and Kandahar, for example. Thousands of people are fleeing their homes. Many hundreds of people have been killed who were innocent civilians, not even involved with the Taliban. So I'm skeptical that we can even call what they're doing in Afghanistan insurgency, a counterinsurgency. Mm. For many Afghans in Kandahar these days, it reminds them of the Russian operations, much more of a massive military offensive. And we're not really winning hearts and minds. And every journalist working in Afghanistan these days agrees that more and more Afghans are turning against the American presence and the international presence in Afghanistan. And I think we talk so much about what the Americans are doing, we don't often talk about whether they should be doing it in the first place. The Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, to distinguish from the Pakistani Taliban, Afghan Taliban are an Afghan-led movement populated by Afghan fighters fighting for Afghanistan. Why are we in Afghanistan fighting Afghans? It totally baffles me. Mm. They don't have any global ambitions. Even if they had those ambitions, they're not sophisticated enough to actually carry them out. But they're interested only in Afghanistan. So it doesn't really make much sense to be fighting them in the first place. And there doesn't seem to be much attempt at reconciling with them anyway. Right now, the focus is on killing and capturing Taliban commanders, which is only actually radicalizing the movement. So I'm very skeptical about the entire war in Afghanistan, and I feel like there hasn't been much explanation of what the strategy is. There are tactical explanations. Counterinsurgency is a tool. It's a tactic, but it's not a strategy.
In the meantime, there's a sort of revolutionary strategic doctrine, it seems to me, that nobody talks about, coming after Colin Powell's sort of Vietnam-based experience. His rule was short wars, preferably deserts. We don't do mountains. Overwhelming force. Exit strategies before anybody goes in. Public support at home and get it done. We seem to have backed into an exactly opposite strategy. Not just mountains, but endless war. I mean, on the Petraeus schedule seems to go to his lifetime, his children's lifetime, my grandchildren's lifetime. And people like Andrew Bacevich, for example, make a big point. Military guy, also of the Vietnam era, who thinks, wait a sec, how many times are we going to learn this, that it doesn't work?
Well, it's ironic that we've adopted Al-Qaeda's view of the world. Al-Qaeda believes there's some kind of global battlefield, global war against Jews and crusaders and infidels. And countries don't matter. And Obama has continued all the pathologies of the Bush administration. It's a global war against sort of an undefined enemy, an idea, a movement, a symbol, not a nation state, Al-Qaeda, or Islamic extremism. But ironically, as a result of our wars, Al-Qaeda has gone from being a marginal, insignificant phenomenon to a much more important one throughout the Muslim world. You had 200 guys who belonged to Al-Qaeda, more or less, at the time of 9/11. And they got lucky in 9/11 and were able to murder 3,000 people. But as a result of that, we went to war in Iraq and Afghanistan. We bombed Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, conducted operations in other countries as well. And we spent trillions of dollars on this war without an end, all for a couple of hundred relatively unsophisticated extremists who, in the grand scheme of things, were able to conduct only a pinprick on the great American empire, which didn't cause that much damage. The damage was caused by our overreaction to September 11, internally and externally.
I hear you, and I'm noting on page 470 of your wonderful book exactly the spot where you developed this argument. You write in the book, despite admitting that there was no military solution, Obama was relying on the military. And he reproduced the pathologies of his predecessor, treating Muslims as if they were one entity and the world as if it was a battlefield. You write, there was a certain absurdity in this American force taking aim at 200 unsophisticated extremists. But you also write, many in the defense policy establishment were nostalgic for a real enemy, like fascism or communism. So they made the conflict about culture. And the United States, as you say, adopted Al-Qaeda's view. This takes us back to Samuel Huntington and the Class of Civilizations notion. I said to Sam Huntington once on the radio, it seems to me you've developed methadone for Cold War addicts. You've invented a clash of cultural significance, of worldwide scope that could go on forever, partly out of nostalgia for this enormous long Cold War confrontation with Russian communism.
I think Huntington certainly, when you look at when he developed his Clash of Civilizations theory and he began looking for new enemies, was following the Cold War. It was as if we got rid of one enemy. Now we need to find another one to justify our massive military expenditure and our militaristic approach to dominating the world. And for now, Muslims are a good candidate. But Al-Qaeda is such a marginal phenomenon in the Middle East and in the Muslim world that just doesn't make any sense. If you visit Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, the concerns people have are much more mundane. Basic survival, education, farming. Nobody cares about Al-Qaeda. They don't have a newspaper. They're on the internet, but only if a few angry teenagers or young men really pay attention to these YouTube videos. They just don't matter, and they're never going to control a village or a province or a country. They've become more important thanks to us, thanks to our approach, but it's not a threat. It's a nuisance, really, for a great American empire like the U.S., and we treat them as if they're some kind of, as if there's, as they say, a war of ideas, as if Al-Qaeda threatens to take over and dominate the Muslim world, when it's just a joke. If you visit the Arab world, nobody cares about them. There's no war of ideas because they're not a participant in it. There are authoritarian governments, and you have millions of people living under their oppression who would like to overthrow them. But none of them seek to impose some kind of Taliban-like state, or very few. It's just not a realistic threat. It's not whether in terms of ideas, let alone its military capabilities. And as we've seen, they have had no successes since September 11. I mean, the Madrid bombers were inspired by Al-Qaeda, but they were acting independently. We had the underwear bomber, which is more of a joke than anything else. They are just not something we should be taking so seriously.
It seems to me, Nir Rosen, that in this vast book of a miserable decade, the one great might-have-been or turning point that was missed was this definition of Al-Qaeda back in 01, when it might, as you say, have been cast in the media, in our politics, as, yes, the perpetrators of 9/11 and a very strange and small, poisonous, but isolated gang. One more important question we've got to touch on is the cover story in The Economist this week about rumblings of a serious war in Lebanon again, a war that Israel would start to finish the confrontation with Hezbollah. Do we take this seriously or not? In what sense is it a kind of representative warning of troubles ahead?
There is going to be a war between Israel and Lebanon, Israel and Palestinians, perhaps even other countries. It's inevitable. I don't think it's imminent necessarily. I think neither side is ready for that. But the Israeli military dominates the Israeli government. Former officers and generals make up many of the cabinet ministers. And if, for the most part, you can't be a prime minister in Israel unless you have Arab blood on your hands. So, yes, there will be a war. Israel won't tolerate any powerful threats on its borders. And Hezbollah is powerful for a number of reasons. It's a very strong military, as we saw when it defeated Israel in 2006. But it's also a powerful symbol, because Hezbollah's 2006 victory over Israel demolished forever the notion that Israel will dominate the Arab world. It demolished Israel's deterrence and inspired people throughout the Middle East that there was some hope to ending the Israeli occupation, that there was some challenge to oppression in the region. So it's a threat not only to Israel. As we saw, Hezbollah became a threat symbolically even to Saudi Arabia and Egypt and other Sunni dictatorships in the region who have been accommodating the Americans and the Israelis and collaborating with them in some way. It was a very symbolic victory, very popular with Palestinians, both Palestinian citizens of Israel and the Palestinians living in the occupied territories. I don't think that it's an imminent war, but it is inherent in the logic of Zionism, a need to destroy all potential rivals and be the neighborhood bully. I think what we're going to see, though, the two-state solution is dead. Everybody knows that one way or the other.
Who says everybody knows? I mean, the White House.
Everybody in the region. American officials as well. It's a charade. There is no two-state solution. Israel has, not that that was necessarily ever the ideal solution, but Israel has destroyed that solution. It's totally separated Gaza from the West Bank. The West Bank is divided into a bunch of little ghettos surrounded by walls. Much of the land has been taken over by Israeli settlements or Israeli roads that are only open to Jews living in the West Bank, to settlers. There's no way that the Israelis are going to voluntarily remove 500,000 settlers from occupied territory. That they, every single Israeli action shows you that they are committed to expanding their control over the West Bank and over the Golan Heights, which are also occupied, and East Jerusalem, which is also occupied, and that they are looking to expel the Palestinians living in Israel. Because right now, in historic Palestine, you basically have one state. You have the Israeli government ruling over Jews and non-Jews, whether they're in Gaza, the West Bank, or in Tel Aviv. And you have different categories of citizens. You have Jewish citizens, who, of course, have full rights. And then you have non-Jewish citizens who are, if they're the Palestinian citizens of Israel, about 1 million of them, are third-rate citizens. And you have a few more million Palestinians living in Gaza and the West Bank, also under Israeli rule. But with no rights. They can be killed on a daily basis. They have no rights and they're being dispossessed on a daily basis. If Israel wants to be a Jewish democracy, as they say, they can't tolerate this non-Jewish presence, which is now, it's almost 50-50. By 2014, it will be 50-50, they say. They need to get rid of the remaining non-Jews. It's inherent in the logic. More than half of the Israeli Jews support what they call transfer. Some kind of ethnic cleansing. I mean, this is a state, Israel, which, as everybody knows, was founded between 1947 and 1949 on the expulsion of close to 1 million of its indigenous population. They fled to the West Bank, to Gaza, to Jordan, to Kuwait. And in 1967, hundreds of thousands more were expelled. And there's been a continuous process of expulsion and dispossession. It's a colonial project to remove the native inhabitants and replace them with foreign settlers, whether they're Jews from Poland or Iraq or elsewhere. And you now have almost parity between the Jews and non-Jews living there. Zionism can't tolerate that. They're going to have to be removed. You have a foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, in Israel, who openly says that.
Right.
It's astonishing that he's welcomed in the international community as if that's okay. You have half the population in Israel, which the Jewish population, which openly accepts expulsion of non-Jews. This is a pariah state, and I think that you will see an attempt to expel the non-Jewish citizens of Israel into the West Bank, into Jordan. It's talked about on a as if it's a normal thing and a normal issue you can discuss in Israeli media.
Nir, let me ask. I mean, you're not the only one who sees the two-state negotiations about negotiations as a charade. But at the American level, the serious policy level, even the Israel lobby level, what are the real preparations being made for the kind of reality you're talking about?
Well, when you talk to American officials on the ground, people working, for example, for the American consulate in Jerusalem, they're quite open. I was taken on a tour a couple of years ago by an American official, American diplomat, working at the American consulate in Jerusalem. He took me around East Jerusalem, and he was outraged, showed me all the violations, all the Israeli theft of land and expulsion of Palestinians in East Jerusalem. And he said that they report all these things to Washington, but that policy to Israel is determined by the White House. It's more of a domestic issue. I certainly think that the American government is aware of this. They're there. I think that they don't care, and they're buying time for the Israelis. The peace process has been very much a way to buy time for Israel to fulfill its conquest of the West Bank. I mean, they've doubled settler population and the settlements. They've created a Palestinian partner who has no popularity on the ground, but is a collaborates with the occupation. It's something maybe unprecedented in the history of national liberation movements, that you have a national liberation movement which is cooperating with the occupier and with the dispossessor against its own people. So from an Israeli point of view, they can feel like in the short term they have won. The Israeli economy is thriving. Violence against Israelis is minimal. You can sip your cappuccino by the beach in Tel Aviv and feel like you don't have a care in the world, not thinking about the ethnic cleansing and dispossession that's happening half an hour away from you. When you're in Israel, it's something which, if you're any kind of moral person, just blows your mind. Everybody you meet, the waiter in your restaurant, your taxi driver, they've all, having served in the military, they've all been involved in the occupation, or they still are involved in it. Your waiter might have been a sniper, and he serves reserve duty once a year in the West Bank. Or maybe he shoots tear gas at people and arrests Palestinian youth. Your taxi driver, the lawyer, the guy who gives you your beach chair in the beach. Everybody is involved in this massive occupation and dispossession.
It's a fascinating contrast. You say everybody in Iraq knows somebody, some family member, some neighbor, some friend, father, son, mother, who's been victimized by this war, and everybody in Israel has some personal, direct, equally individual experience of occupation too. Nir Rosen, let me just sum up with an observation and a question. The observation is that you yourself are such a striking, an exemplary character, sort of a man alone out there listening to people above all, drawing his own conclusions, writing, you know, print the news and be damned kind of account of our times in that world. That's the observation. The question is, what if the United States had both media and a government that made its work of listening to people, doing it the Nir Rosen way?
Well, then I guess we wouldn't be the United States. we would be a different country. We wouldn't be this great imperial power if we had a government that listened to other people. It's just almost impossible to imagine. I don't even know how to answer that question. It's a fantasy to think that we'll have a government which listens to our... Forget about people in Iraq. You know, they're far away, they're brown, they don't speak our language, who cares about them? Listening to our own people, even the Obama administration, as we see. The U.S. governments, unfortunately, are controlled by a handful of rich corporations and rich people who fund both political parties. And it's in defense of the elite and of the minority of wealthy people who dominate our society. And the needs of most people are ignored here. So surely the needs of people in faraway places are going to be ignored as well.
Nir Rosen, you exemplify another way. It's a privilege. It's a thrill. We love your work. What is your next mission?
I'm leaving tonight for Iraq, actually. I'm going to work for 2 weeks for a humanitarian NGO. I'll be writing on the side. It's getting harder and harder to find work as a journalist, so I'm very flattered by the attention you've given me. Because I don't think you said I exemplify another way. I don't think I do, because you can't make any money this way. I mean, journalism is dying as it is, but certainly this kind of journalism, there's no money in it, and it's so expensive to get to these places that it's getting more and more difficult. I might be at the peak of my career, but it almost feels like it's sort of at its end.
Don't give it up. Don't give it up. We can't afford it, and we'll find ways to help you. I mean it.
Well, thank you.
It's a huge gift to be able to talk with you like this, and I thank you enormously for your work and for this conversation.
Thank you.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.